My name is Maria Garden, also known as Mimi, and I am 71 years old. Today's date is March 3rd, 2020, and I am in Las Cruces at the university hosting the Military Voices StoryCorps program right now. And the name of my interview partner today is Barry Dunleavy, and he's a friend who I have known for a number of years and I think has something worthwhile to say in the Military Voices.
Well, I hope so. My name is Barry Dunleavy. I'm 88, which takes me back from the military point of view to the Korean War. Sometimes it's called the Forgotten War, but at any rate, it still lives with me a little bit. Today's date is March 3rd. The location is Las Cruces. My interview partner, whom you've just heard from, is Mimi Gardner, and our relationship is friends for quite a few years now. Thanks. So
what we want to speak about today is your history, and in particular, touching on those parts in your life that are related also to the military, not just specifically military, but related to them. So let's go back and start with you going into the Marines and what the situation was at that time in the United States in your life. I think that was
1949? 1950.
Close,
yeah. Okay, so... Historically speaking, what happened back in 1949, 1950, specifically 1950, and at that time I was an 18-year-old high school graduate. But the war came from the point of view of Korea when the North Korean forces on June 25th, 1950, invaded South Korea. And at that time, the first thing that happened, and most of us at that time lived with the memories of World War II and were not expecting another war to come along involving the United States. But Harry Truman was president at the time, and when the North Koreans invaded the South, he immediately sent American troops that were stationed in Japan, he sent them in to Korea to stop the advances of the North Korean. And there was a whole question of communism and the stop of the spread of communism. So as an 18-year-old going on 19, and the war is beginning to rage, so to speak, all of the young people, my friends, we thought, well, we've got to go into the service. Maybe we'll get drafted. Maybe I don't want to get drafted and just go into the Army. So I decided, I kind of like the idea of the Marine Corps. I have to admit that at the time I was about 19, I'd seen John Wayne in Sands of Iwo Jima, a popular movie at the time. So the idea of the Marine Corps was very appealing to a youngster like me at the time. So I went down and spoke to my parents and said that's what I wanted to do. And went down to the recruiting station in Boston, Massachusetts, signed up, and they gave me a date to report to the Marine Corps. We took a train down to Parris Island, South Carolina, began infantry training, basic training down at Parris Island. So that's the beginning of my career. And eventually I was sent to Korea after advanced infantry training and spent almost exactly 1 year there, June 51 to June 52.
Could you tell us a little bit about the close order drill that you learned at your basic training, which I've heard you mention before?
One of the great values of close order drill is that it makes you part of a body of people, in this case mostly young men, and you learn to march in step together, respond to commands, to march to the right, to the left, or turn around and go backwards, you know. So, but it's an organizational thing that organizes everybody, and that it makes you realize that you're part of an active body of men with a mission to do. You know? But it can carry over into a degree, and I always thought it would be interesting to put it into high schools and colleges. Nobody would go for it, I don't think, at the time, close order drill. But it has that facility for making you part of a group of people setting out to do something or create something.
So you mentioned also that you were doing advanced infantry training there at boot camp?
Well, that's after boot camp. I thought I might get assigned to some more glorious activity in the military or in the Marine Corps. There was some talk that my psychological profile said I could possibly be a air control person for the Marine Air Wing. But no, when it was announced after basic training, my assignment was for infantry and to report to Oceanside, California for advanced infantry training, which was another 10 weeks or so, and after which we boarded a ship, USNS General William Weigel. I still remember that years later. And after about 14 trips across the Pacific, we reached Japan, had a day off in Japan, and then joined the U.S. forces in Korea at that time. We were just beginning to get a handle on the military situation in South Korea. And that took we had been pushed down to, American forces had been pushed down to the southernmost tip of the Korean Peninsula around the city of Busan, and it became known as the Busan Perimeter. And that's where we almost got pushed into the South China Sea, I think it was. But from that point on, the American forces began to push back the North Korean forces. And of course, historically, the Chinese then came in and reinforced the North Korean, so it became a much longer battle, a much longer fight in Korea. Yeah.
So what happened to you there then? Can you tell us about your battle experiences?
Well, I would just say the most noteworthy of the experiences was we were in the mountainous area of Korea, and the unit there, we each person had a, or each part of the unit there had to take their responsibilities, and one day we had to go on patrol from our positions up in the hill and go down to the valley floor, and I'm not sure, we were just the Marine grunts, I suppose they can say. They didn't tell us why we were going down or what we were doing. But as I say, when we reached the floor, we started marching along a berm that was close to what was once an active rice paddy. And as we were marching along in single file, not quite knowing what we were looking for and where we were going, we got a word from the front of the command, front of the column, to turn around and go back. Well, as soon as I heard that, and I think this is the same with others, and that was a big no-no. You didn't turn around and go back the way you came. You kept going and found another way around. Because, and this is what happened, as soon as we turned around and started back, and I had just, I was near the back. I had been near the back, but when we turned around, I was near the front. So I began the ascent up the hill into a broad, grassy area, when all of a sudden, rifle fire from across the valley erupted, and bullets were hitting around it. But those fellows who had not started the climb up were somewhat protected, and myself and another fellow, we hit the ground. And there was no cover, but just make it a low as possible target for the shooters. And the worst part of it is that I became the bullseye of a target from across the valley, and the bullets would hit around me left and right. And I knew at any point one of them might go through my head or heart or whatever, but all you could do is hug the earth and hope for the best. I did, after a while, something hit my leg down on the right thigh, and I thought one of the bullets had probably kicked up a stone or a pebble, so I slid my hand down my right thigh, and when I pulled it back, there was blood on it, so it wasn't just a hit. A rock hitting the my thigh, but one of the bullets had finally found me as a target. But at that time, things began to slow down. The firing began to slow down, and we weren't quite sure what was happening. Doug Ellison was a fellow behind me and had a significant amount of cover. But he called up to me and he said, "Barry, can you make a run for it? We want to break out of this situation." And I knew the bullet had not hit the bone in my leg. So I said, no, I can run. So well, hold on a minute. And then the word came up, let's go. So we all broke up and headed up this foothill. And as soon as we got to the top of the ridge and got over to the other side, we know that we were free. The rifle fire could not reach us there. But by this time, things had quieted down, and I got a corpsman came and put a typical military bandage on my leg and called in a helicopter. And as I mentioned to you before, that people who are familiar with the MASH program, which it was the same Bell helicopter that came in and picked me up, and it had one or two beds, one on each side, and I was just as happy to climb into that compartment on the left side of the helicopter. It lifted off, and all I could see lying there was the blue sky ahead of me, and the realization I was still alive. A bit of a wound in the leg, but nothing too serious. In fact, within 7 to 10 days, it might have been even 7 or less days, you know, I was released from the MASH unit, and sent back to my unit, and then to carry on with the, whatever the unit was doing at that time. So that was the most telling adventure that I had from a military point of view with the Marine Corps.
And you remained there and fought with your wounded leg? You were okay enough to do that?
To run?
No, to stay there. And for how long were you there then continuing your service?
Oh, I got over there in June of 1951, June of 51, and the situation I'm talking about here was in late September, and then I wasn't rotated home until June of 52, so I stayed with the unit and whatever we were doing. But at that time, peace talks had begun, and the peace talks meant there was very little action on either side. There were two lines facing each other. The North Koreans on the north, and us on the other side. And we just it was almost after taking various lands in military action, we stopped and became almost a security force on the battle line there. And that's when we would send patrols out to see what's happening out in the valley. And and it became a bit of a stalemate from then on. And finally in June of 52, I had finished my year and was happy to pack up and go home.
And you left the military with something like a medal?
Well, yeah, a Purple Heart medal, which is, which is nice to get. It says that you served your country in a very specific way, and that it cost you a bit of a wound, and some, of course, get much worse, but. You begin to respect situations like that and awards like that. That it says that you did what was expected of you as a Marine or as a representative of the country, and in a situation trying to make the situation in Korea more tenable.
And this concept of service to your country is something important to you.
Yes, for a young person, I think at that time that it's something that did begin to resonate within me that, hey, I've done something specific endured the discomfort of a wound, but it said, you know, that's what they sent me here for, was to do my part. And I think after the whole military experience, one of the things I liked, or the idea that appealed to me most, is that I did everything that was asked of me, and I think that that's what any soldier, Marine, Airman, Navy man, the best thing that they can say, I served my country and I did everything that was asked of me. So I would not have missed the experience for the world, you know.
So you return now to the U.S., and what did you do following your military experience?
Well, I eventually I had another year to serve on my original enlistment, but I was assigned to the Boston Navy Yard security detail. That was nearest my home at the time. And after that, I finished up. I was released or discharged from with an honorary release. I was finished with my military time, and so I always liked the Korean people and the Korean. I ran into, after the Marine Corps, one of the priests on the local church, and wanted to know what I was going to do with myself now that I was back and free to choose something. He asked me if I'd ever thought of becoming a priest, and I said, I guess a lot of young fellows do at one time or another think maybe they would like to become a priest. So I went off to the seminary, and the seminary was run by the Marian Old Fathers, which was a mission organization, and part of that, the appeal of that is, again, it has that youthful appeal to it, is maybe I could go back to Korea as a missionary and so forth. That never happened, but it was a strong motivation at the time. I eventually settled down, decided. One of the things that happened in the seminary is that each class would put on a class play. The seminary was the beginning. It was set up as a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and each class put on a play. And I eventually decided to leave the seminary because I was in each one of the plays each year, and I suddenly realized, hey, this is what I really like to do, you know. So I left the seminary. I called home and told my mother and father that I was going to come home. And the next day, this is a small town south of Boston, and I told them that I really wanted to pursue the idea of being an actor. And they didn't poo-poo the idea. They said, well, that's what you want to do. And my father was going down to New York on business the very next day. And he said, well, why don't you come with me and you can get started on your career as an actor. So I got in, went down to the next morning. I drove down from the Boston area down to New York City. And he left me at the corner of 8th Avenue and 57th Street. And I was on my own to pursue my acting career. So it worked out very well. At the time I went to see, there was an outfit called the Catholic Actors Guild. And at the time I went and I saw a lady there, and she said, well, you really need to get some training. So as it turned out, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York were about to start their spring semester. So that got me started on my acting career, and it all eventually worked out very well.
And this isn't the first thing you were studying, though. When you were at the seminary, you were there for long enough to get a degree also.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. That I owe a great debt of gratitude to Marian Old, because I had a four-year education and graduated from that part of the seminary with an AB or BA degree. And that served me well ever since. So my thanks to Marian Old.
and quite thorough knowledge of Latin.
Of Latin?
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes. I am. When I heard that, when I told people I wanted to go into the seminary, they said, well, you've got to take, I had had some high school Latin, but I had to get, I had to take a year of Latin studies, just all one whole academic year just studying Latin. It worked out. It worked out all right. I would advise anybody who wants an education to study some Latin, because so much of the our words, our language, are of Latin origin and so forth. But so that was good from that point of view. Yeah.
So here we are back in New York. You've been dropped off on the corner.
Yeah.
And where did you go? What did you do? You eventually found out you had to go to this dramatic school. But what happened when your father dropped you off on the corner?
Well, we had there was an elderly couple who lived in New York City, and they were part of the family. I didn't know them too well until I got down here, down to New York. But that was one of the, that's what I, as far as a port in the storm, I had been given their number, Bill and Margaret McCluskey were the name, and I had their phone number, so I called them up and I told them that I was down in the city, that I was Barry Dunleavy, a distant relative. I forget how I put it, but they took me in that night, and I eventually couldn't stay with them forever. So after a week, or I think it was at least a couple of weeks, I went off on my own and started combing the streets of Midtown Manhattan, looking for a room to rent. And then that was the next step for getting established in New York and pursuing my acting career. I found a room on 303 West 54th Street. It's no longer in existence, but at the time, for $7, I had a room. And as I said before, there was no extra charge for the cockroaches, but it was a great experience. You know, you don't appreciate until you look back and see it. And I found a night job so that I could in a bank, so that I could have money to support myself and go to school in the daytime at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And eventually I graduated from there. And to keep moving along, a couple who had a summer theater in Dorset, Vermont, saw me in one of the plays at the Academy. So they invited me to come to join their company in Dorset for the summer season. That was summer season was 1961. So we did 10 plays in 10 weeks. So that was a great experience of being thrown into a theater milieu and having to put up a play every one play every week. You had to do a lot of hustling and learning of lines and go from one play to another.
So fast forwarding to a retirement here for both of us in Deming, I was able to enjoy a performance at a theater that we have there in Deming in what was formerly the railroad station that you wrote and directed. So I think it, because it has to do a lot with the military also, I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that came out of the seminary experience is they used to read to you when you had when you came down for meals, so that particularly at the noon meal, you would eat the meal, of course, but you're listening to a book. Often it was theological in nature or religious in tone. But one night, day they came down to dinner, midday lunch, midday, and they started a book, and it said the reader at that time said, "Give us this day by Sidney Stewart," and then it started the book, and it was a story of about the Bataan Death March, and being prisoner of the Japanese for three years. And Sidney Stewart wrote the book, as I say, and it was one of these things that after the theological theses that we would often have come down every day and hear another chapter or so of this story was very moving, and I could see it in my head like a movie. And I never forgot that. And then as soon as I had the opportunity, I found a copy of it at the Strand Bookstore in Lower Manhattan. And eventually I found Sidney Stewart living in Paris. He was still alive. I made a trip over, saw him, got the rights to it. He was very exciting to meet him, because you realize what this man went through for his country too, as a soldier and as a veteran. And the Bataan Death March is a whole other story, you know. But it was a great experience, and I was able to fashion a script both for a movie version and also as a stage version. So the stage version that you saw was the one that everybody in Deming got to see. That was the premiere performance of Give Us This Day by Sidney Stewart. So on stage at and then eventually came here to Las Cruces, and we did it on Veterans Day at the Santa Fe Theater, I think it is. Yeah. So that's been a very important part of my life, Give Us This Day.
And before that, you also taught writing, in Deming, for a number of years. And between this beginning and end of our story, you were also an editor for a local newspaper in Upper Manhattan for about 40 years, I believe.
Yeah, well, it was almost exactly 10 years.
Oh, 10.
Sort of 10 years. By this time, I was married and with two children, and we were living in, my wife and I and the kids were living in Upper Manhattan. And we realized that there was no newspaper. You had the New York Times, of course, and the Daily News, but there was nothing for our neighborhood in Upper Manhattan, North Manhattan, usually known as Inwood. And so I happened to we published a tentative effort, and through that, I met a young woman with actual journalism experience, and we got some money from the Riverdale Press, north of us, to start a paper in Upper Manhattan. So that's what we did. It was, as somebody said, trying to sell advertising and the like for the newspaper. It was like trying to make roses bloom in the desert. But it lasted nearly 10 years, and it did provide every week news from a political and social point of view for all of us living in the top of Manhattan. So that was good. Yeah.
Sounds like you had a life of service to your community.
Yes, I suppose if you look at it that way, it is a life of service. I'm pleased that we were able to do something like create a newspaper. And there's still people who remember it, even though quite a few years ago now. I just think a lot of that comes out of the veterans' experience of serving your country, going to serve your country. I like the idea of, I think I mentioned this to you. You used to hear quite a bit about, especially if somebody who was in the military and died, he was a real hero for us. I tend to think that the real heroes were those, as I mentioned before, all of the young men and women now who serve in the military for our country. They are heroes, giving service to their country, and they gain a lot. They realize that a life of service has its own rewards. You feel like you're doing something worthwhile for people. Yeah.
And not to forget that you are 88 now, and you were directing last year Shakespeare in the Park in Manhattan, which is pretty remarkable for anyone 88 years old.
And I was 87 then.
87. So. Oh, I see. Just a young whippersnapper.
Yes, just a young whippersnapper.
Okay. And that was King Lear?
King Lear, yes. And it was in the park in Upper Manhattan, Inwood Hill Park. And I think I told you the story which pleased me is that I was walking my dog one evening from out from the apartment, and it was getting dark, and I saw this group of people, a couple of women, and behind them, I don't know whether the fellow was with the young women or not, but he saw me and he said, isn't your name George? And I said, no, it's not George. You know, and I think it's a mistaken identity or something. And he said, but didn't you have something to do with a play in the park? Oh, King Lear? Yeah, King Lear. And he said, I just want to tell you that was one of the best afternoons I spent in a New York City park watching King Lear in the park. So things like that, looking at it from a point of view of service, that's one of the rewards that you get when people really appreciate something that you've done.
Well, I think that's just great. And I really love your story. It was fun.
Yes, and well, thank you very much, Mimi. I appreciate the conversation with you.
Okay. So thank you.